This is Molly Smith, host of From the Median. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Mary Eberstadt, Senior Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Her topic is Myths About the Sexual Revolution.
Thank you, Star. Thank you, everybody. It's a little bit daunting to be here at Cleveland Right to Life. First of all, Star makes me feel bad because I forgot my lipstick. Father Gerard makes me feel bad because I don't have one master's degree, let alone a string of them. And then there's Molly Smith, who I've just met for the first time last night. And some of you out there of a certain age will know that there's a movie called The Unsinkable Molly Brown. I think you have the unstoppable Molly Smith. I'd like to give her a round of applause. Thank you very much again for having me here today. I want to share some thoughts with you about why the subject I'm bringing up is important and how I got interested in it in the first place. The subject is the sexual revolution and its myths and their destructive legacy in our time. I do believe that understanding the real legacy of the sexual revolution is important to the pro-life cause. And the reason is that widespread falsehoods and myths about that revolution have kept people away from understanding the truths of the pro-life movement. So in this talk, I want to give some examples of the myths of the sexual revolution and also give you some facts that you can use to counter those myths in your everyday life. My purpose is to arm you, figuratively speaking, with empirical evidence so that you can defend yourselves when challenged in the secular world about what it means to be pro-life. And you will be challenged, as many of you already know, and as the younger of you will certainly find out. We live in an era when many people believe that religious traditionalists, meaning specifically those who defend the traditional Christian moral code, are in retreat. Certainly, many Christians themselves feel this. Even among those who try to stand aside or above the clashes here and there in the public square, an uneasy sense of defeat still hangs over many, as the very unchristian and even anti-Christian realities of our world become clear. In certain terrible precincts of the globe, some of our fellow believers are being persecuted for their beliefs as never before. In certain more comfortable precincts, like our own, believers are mercifully free from bodily persecution, but even so, many face unexpected and increasing pressure to conform to a worldview that denies biblical truth. If we look over to Western Europe, for example, we see that even in the generally like-minded United Kingdom, these are uneasy times. In one recent legal case, a Christian man was jailed for reading the Bible aloud on the street. As for the United States, in some places, religious behavior that was unremarkable and even considered praiseworthy until very recently is now increasingly ostracized and penalized. We have our legal cases, too, as you all know, and more of them by the month. So that's the bad news. The good news, and it is amazingly good news, is that we also live in a time when these same most unpopular and unwanted teachings, namely pro-life teachings, are being vindicated as never before. We have already seen that happen in the case of abortion. The sonogram, combined with the selfless pro-life movement, has done what seemed impossible back in 1973. It has rolled back the clock of public opinion. That's an incredible achievement. And it goes to the heart of my message today, which is to look for allies in secular evidence and scientific and historical evidence wherever you can. You don't know when tomorrow's evidence will become your best friend. Let's take some examples. Let me talk about myth number one. Christianity needs to get with the program. It's stuck somewhere in the Middle Ages. It doesn't understand the modern world. I'm sure all of you have heard varieties of this myth. In 2008, I wrote an essay for First Things magazine called about Humanae Vitae for what was then the 40th anniversary. And many of you know what that document is, but for those who don't, it is one of the most unpopular public documents in the history of the last 50 years, and it put the kick me sign on traditional Christianity forever, at least in the mind of many secular people. How on earth, people have asked ever since, could the church possibly defend the teaching against artificial contraception? Didn't it want to join the modern world? How could the church take issue with the sexual revolution? So I read this document in order to write about it, which was incredibly scrupulous of me and not something that journalists always do. And it's no exaggeration to say that that experience changed my life somewhat. Because the document said, or the document made several predictions about what the world would look like once the sexual revolution took hold. That is, once artificial contraception was widely destigmatized alongside extramarital sex itself. The document predicted that the results would be a lessening of respect for women by men, a tendency for coercive governments to use this new technology coercively, more broken homes, and a generalized rise in romantic problems between the sexes. The reason these predictions amazed me was simple and yet profound. As a researcher who had studied and written about various aspects of American society over the years, I knew from an entirely secular point of view that all of these predictions had come true. In fact, Humanae Vitae has been vindicated as few documents or prophecies ever are, in ways that its authors could not possibly have foreseen. I refer you to the use of coercive birth control technology in China and India after the document was written, by information that did not exist when the document was penned, by scholars and others with no interest whatever in its religious teaching, and even inadvertently by many proud public adversaries of the church. And the greatest irony of all, to repeat, was that what the church said there has been vindicated by secular sources. Secular social science assembled by secular social scientists appearing in secular journals. It was not theology that was vindicating the encyclical, I argued, but thinkers like Kay Heimowitz and George Gilder and sociologist Lionel Tiger, that is his name, and many others whom I could and did name. Their scholarship about things like broken homes and relations between the sexes and lots of other interrelated questions had gone to show that Humanae Vitae was right. The citations for all of that and more are in a book called Adam and Eve After the Pill. The point of the story is that this experience taught me two things. One was the importance of playing offense, not defense, in the public square. The other team is going to do everything it can to stop you, so you might as well get the ball further down the field than not. You know, this is for the students here. Do you know this video game saying, the cake is a lie? The cake is a lie. See, everyone here is just too well-formed to be playing video games. It's incredible. It's actually more for the college set, but it's a line that pops up during what I'm told is a particularly tense moment in a video game where you've been going toward a goal and going toward the goal, and then you find out that the goal is a lie. The sexual revolution is kind of like that. It's had negative fallout, sometimes catastrophically negative fallout, for men, women, and children across the globe. And I find that using the secular evidence about that fallout sometimes gives pause to people who otherwise find Judeo-Christianity ridiculous. But those are the people I try to reach with my own work, the people in the secular square. They're the people we all have to reach if we're going to include more people in the pro-life cause. So we're not here to talk to ourselves in a corner, but to recruit other people wherever and whenever we can find them. So let's go to myth number two of the sexual revolution. The idea that sexual liberty is somehow wrong or problematic is just some weird Christian thing. Nobody else cares. This is what a lot of people think, isn't it? At least I hear it a lot. I'm sure you hear it a lot. Some of us hear it even within our own families. We heard this myth quite a lot during the debates over the HHS mandate, when a lot of secular people had a field day hating on traditional Christianity and mocking its teachings. But going again to the evidence, is it true that concern about the sexual revolution has just been some backward Christian thing? The answer, historically, is no, it is not. So let's get in a quickie history lesson. Some of you know this, but for those who don't, this is also useful ammunition. In the first place, it was not only the Catholic Church, but all the Protestant churches that historically condemned artificial contraception. John Calvin condemned it. Martin Luther condemned it. And as a matter of fact, their particular condemnations made anything the popes have said sound tame. There was unanimity about this teaching within the Christian world up until 1930, when the Anglican Communion at the conference at Lambeth in England made the first very carefully circumscribed exceptions to the rule, after which, as it were, all hell broke loose. For the historical record, traditional Judaism also condemned contraception, as has traditional Islam. And the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, also regard it as something only allowable in certain carefully circumscribed circumstances. My point is not to get into these theological differences, but rather to make a pan-religious point, a historical point. The modern myth that concern over the sexual revolution is just some bizarre preoccupation of the Catholics and the conservative Protestants is just wrong. It's also wrong from a thoroughly secular perspective. Some pretty towering minds here and there who examined this question of whether the change in sexual mores would be a good thing or a bad thing for the world are also on record over the centuries. And none of these people were flacks for the Apostolic Palace in Rome. For example, fabled journalist and thinker Walter Lippmann, a founder of the New Republic magazine, thought the sexual revolution would be epic, and he explicitly agreed with the Catholic Church that it was the most important change of modern times. Another immensely learned scholar named Ptiram Sorokin, who actually founded Harvard University's Department of Sociology, wrote an entire book called The American Sex Revolution in the 1960s. In it, he deplored the way the sexual revolution was changing relations between men and women and within the family. He said the resulting change would be catastrophic. Actually, his book makes anything that I have read on the subject sound tame by comparison. Here's a quote. "Sex obsession," argued Sorokin, "bombards us continually. From cradle to grave, from all points of our living space, at almost every step of our activity, feeling, and thinking," unquote. That was decades ago, and it makes you wonder what he would have made of the internet. The book, incidentally, was itself based on a widely discussed article that Sorokin wrote for Life magazine on the same subject. Imagine any Harvard sociologist penning a similar dissent from the sexual revolution today. It's mind-boggling, and it shows you how far we've come, and not in a good way. Well, here are more thinkers from recent decades who discerned that the revolution was changing the world. Libertarian social scientist Charles Murray, secular Jewish essayist Irving Kristol, sociologist Lionel Tiger again, social critic Midge Dechter, and many more who could be named. I recommend all their work to you, and none of them, not one of them, has been a cat's paw of the chair of St. Peter. So maybe it helps to remember some of this recent secular history the next time somebody slams your theology and says that Christians are just weirdly hung up about sex. It isn't empirically or historically true. Plenty of people had a near consensus on this subject until just about the day before yesterday. So here's one more point to make when people clinging to this myth say that it's all just some repressed Christian thing. The fallout from the revolution is actually an everybody thing. You could be a Benedictine monk. You could be Lady Gaga's biggest fan. It doesn't matter, in the sense that you will still be affected by the revolution economically, personally, and otherwise. The collapse of marriage, for example, means that someone has to support homes without dads in them. The rise in abortion and the collapse in childbearing means that the taxpayer base of the modern state ultimately becomes unsustainable. And anyone who reads the financial pages, seeing what's happening to European economies right now, will be acutely aware of this. The point is that the sexual revolution fuels the welfare state itself, meaning that everyone in the modern state participates one way and another. So let's look at myth number three. The sexual revolution has made people happier. This is the claim advanced on behalf of legalized abortion and every other aspect of sexual license. The idea is that reproductive freedom, as it's called, has been a great benefit to the women of the world. So once again, I want to ask, using evidence, is this true? There is a lot of data to suggest that the answer is no. So in the first place, let's listen to the troops on the ground, as it were. I want to start with the kind of journalism that appears in secular places like The Atlantic Magazine and Time and New York Times, the Better Papers, and that kind of thing. Take a look at the pieces, the style pieces, that are run about today's modern woman. They're fascinating. What secular women say about their condition when they think that they're just talking among themselves ought to be consulted more often because it is more evidence for our side. What do they talk about? Well, they talk about how marriage is impossible and it's time to go it alone. They talk about how unreliable men are and how women are better off without them. They talk about how hard it is to be a single mom and how balancing home and career is more difficult than they thought it would be. They talk about which male friend they should find to be the father of the child they are having without a husband. In other words, they complain a lot, but the way in which they complain tells us something important, I think. This is not the language of women who have been liberated. This is the language of women who have given up on human relationships. It's the language of defeat and unhappiness. And at the root of that unhappiness, one can argue, is the sexual revolution itself, including the millions of abortions that weigh on the consciences not only of society at large, but of individual people. Women, especially secular, sophisticated women, have been told all their lives by cultural authorities that abortion and the revolution, etc., were facts of life that would make them happy. They didn't understand, as secular economists have shown, citations in the book I mentioned, that the revolution had a dark downside for them. It meant that the economic incentives for men to treat women well and to be serious about settling down with any one of them diminished incredibly. Again, George Gilder and Lionel Tiger saw all this coming years ago, but the unhappiness that permeates so much of what modern secular women write is an especially poignant testimony to it. So here's another proof against the happiness claim. This one's for those who like social science. A few years ago, two economists from the Wharton School, which, as many of you know, is the blue-chip business school of America, put out a fascinating paper. It's called The Paradox of Declining Female Happiness. This paper looked at survey data about women, not only in America, but across the Western world, covering the last 35 years. And what the researchers found really perplexed them. It was that women, over these 35 years, were getting less happy as time went on. Men stayed basically the same. Is anyone surprised? This finding of unhappiness didn't make sense to the authors of the paper, because, as they pointed out, during those exact same years, women had many new advantages, including easy access to contraception and abortion. So I submit this is one more paradox that isn't really a paradox. Not if you entertain the radical idea that the revolution itself is making women unhappy. When hookups are easy to find and people don't fear the consequences because they have abortion to fall back on, guys don't have a lot of incentive to get serious about anyone in particular. And look at women who are somewhat older. Why do so many accomplished women simply give up and decide to have children on their own? This is a real thing. If you have friends in major metropolitan areas, you'll be very aware of this phenomenon of the career woman who has a single baby when she is single after the age of 40. Why do they use anonymous sperm donors, creating the world's first purposely fatherless children? Or what about the fact, and this was reported last year and made front page news, that now some 26% of American women are on one or another kind of mental health medication for anxiety and depression and related problems? The most obvious answer to these questions is that something about the way many people live today is making a lot of them miserable. And again, the revolution, which is arguably the biggest social change of the past half century, not only in the United States but around the world, would seem to be the obvious culprit. So here's something to say back to people when they tell you that the way of the post-revolutionary world is a better one. Point out that the revolution puts new obstacles into human relationships. I want only to mention this briefly, but one obvious example here is pornography. Please allow me to refer you to a brilliant and brave piece of work by Arlington, Virginia's Bishop Paul Loverday on this subject. Pornography makes it harder for people to love each other. It interferes with real live human relationships, and that isn't just the bishop talking. That is therapists, psychiatrists, and medical experts, again, many of them perfectly secular, who are now on public record trying to deal with this fallout of the sexual revolution. This, too, is ammunition for us. So the revolution is the snake in the garden. Happiness for most people, guys as well as girls, has a lot to do with finding a companion to see you through life. Pornography gets in the way of that. The hookup culture that depends on abortion as a backup gets in the way of that. The revolution at large, which tempts people to treat other people as things rather than as beings, gets in the way of all that. So, to summarize, on inspection, it does not appear that the revolution has made people happier after all. Certainly not in the long run. So let's look at one more myth, arbitrarily dubbed myth three. I can't remember if I'm on myth two or three. There are so many of them that I lose track. Four. Thank you. Arithmetic. The sexual revolution is a permanent feature of humanity, and there is no changing that fact. Really? You know, this is probably the most widespread myth of all, and what's interesting about that is that it is the easiest to shoot down. A few years ago, on the 50th anniversary of the pill, there were a lot of celebratory pieces penned in the secular media getting across this very idea. The sexual revolution is the one and only social change in all of human history that is apparently invulnerable to history's vicissitudes. People said the genie can't go back in the bottle. People said there's no turning back the clock. Has anybody heard these things? People said we can't go back to the 1950s. People said the Ozzie and Harriet days are over. And whenever I speak on college campuses, inter alia, I have to stop and explain the whole Ozzie and Harriet thing because, you know, if you're in your 20s, you just don't get it. Okay, there was a sitcom about a family with two kids, and all of these secular and progressive people are obsessed with it. What's that about? It is hard to explain. Well, anyway, there's a long list of cliches trying to get across the idea that the sexual revolution is inevitable. Shakespeare had a great phrase for this kind of rhetorical maneuvering. He called it protesting too much. Inevitable is a very interesting word because history is littered with movements that once claimed inevitability for themselves and that are now as outdated as goldfish eating contests or Yahoo email accounts, etc. Sorry to those who have Yahoo email accounts. Yahoo won't see this, will they? But think Marxism. Think Freudianism, another movement that claimed inevitability on its side. Or think about social phenomena like the gin alleys of London that were cleaned up and made to disappear by Victorian reformers. My point is just that inevitable is a word that careful students of history would never use to describe social movements. And once again, the unexpected but real and important success of the pro-life movement itself goes to show this. So in closing, I want to say a few words that might help with morale out there a little, because as all of us know, the pro-life movement is stronger now than it's ever been before. And in order to keep it that way, everyone needs to understand something. And I'm sending this especially to the students out there. If you don't remember anything else about this talk or this weekend or this year of high school, I want you to remember 7 words. You are more important than you know. You are more important than you know, first, because you are a living, walking contradiction to one of the more toxic notions of our time. That is the idea that people who hold pro-life views are poor, uneducated, and easy to command, in the infamous phrase of a Washington Post reporter describing American evangelicals just about 10 years ago. This is a stereotype to which many people in the secular world unthinkingly subscribe. It is one of the last permissible negative stereotypes. It is also falsifiable, again, by empirical data. A prominent book published in 2010 by secular sociologists Robert Putnam and David Campbell called American Grace, which is a huge compendium of data about religious belief, etc., refutes the notion that religiosity in the United States is a lower class thing. During the first half of the 20th century, the authors observe, college-educated people participated more in churches than did those with less education. I need to let that sink in, because that's really it runs counter to what most of us would suspect. Similarly, after the 1960s, the fall off in church attendance was more dramatic among the less educated than it was among those with college degrees. Or take another book, Coming Apart, The State of White America, by political scientist Charles Murray, tracing the course of the United States from 1960 to 2010. The upper 20% of the American population, Murray shows, using data from the General Social Survey, which is the biggest instrument we have for this kind of thing, the upper 20% are considerably more likely than the lower 30% to say they believe in God and to go to church. You can find similar numbers about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the biggest study ever committed on the Mormons that was not done by Mormons themselves, found exactly this same correlation. The higher up you go that socioeconomic ladder, the more likely people are to be religious, to practice their faith, to give to charity, etc. So remember, if not these specific numbers, this general point, the next time you are challenged for being backward and in the boondocks and on the wrong side of history. This is not what actual secular data go to show. And I'm not saying that so that we can create some new negative stereotype whereby the believers are the top of the heap and the other people are on the bottom. I'm saying it because this is the kind of countercultural finding using perfectly secular evidence that is more ammunition for the pro-life side. You are more important than you know, second, because you can be proud of where you come from in other ways. Here is just a little of what we know now about Christianity in America, thanks to the scholarly efforts of sociologists, psychologists, medical people, and others. First, we know from a growing body of empirical evidence that Christians and Christianity are a net plus in the public square. In the United States, interesting fact, 91% of the people who identify themselves as religious conservatives are likely to give to charity, 91%. As opposed to 67% of those who do not so identify themselves. religious people volunteer at a rate considerably higher than the general population. People who pray every day are 30 percentage points more likely to give to charity than people who never pray. These and other very interesting numbers testify to the existence of what Arthur Brooks has called the charity gap. Incidentally, this charity gap also applies to people of other faiths. Not only Christians, but also Muslims and Jews are more charitable the more religious they are. Religious people, Brooks documents, are also more likely to donate blood than secularists, to give food or money to a homeless person, to return change mistakenly given to them by a cashier. I find that interesting. And to express empathy for less fortunate people. So once again, my point here is not to knock the other side and pat us on the back. It is to say, don't let people tell you that people like you are the problem in the public square. Every time you volunteer in the soup kitchen, or March for Life, or visit the local nursing home, you are more important than you know. The March for Life is actually my favorite example of this. My friend P.J. O'Rourke, who's one of America's great humorists, pointed out years ago, it is the only march on the National Mall that is not undertaken in anybody's self-interest. Interesting fact. And you are more important than you know, finally and most critical of all, because of this. The most underestimated powerful force on the planet may well be the power of example, including your example. I want to tell you a little story here that was told to me by a priest friend who lives in the Washington, D.C. area. In that area where I live, there's a large abortion clinic outside of town that runs practically 24/7. It sounds like the one that some of you are going to visit following this talk. For years, Catholic high school students and parishioners and priests and nuns would take turns praying outside that clinic every Saturday morning. Not talking, not counseling, just praying. Well, one Saturday during the winter, my friend told me, the weather was especially terrible. Nobody wanted to get out of bed. It was Saturday morning and it was snowing. Finally, one lone priest dragged himself over to the clinic, feeling morose and cold and out of sorts. He dropped to his knees in the snow, just asking for strength and a better attitude. And unbeknownst to that priest at that moment, a young woman on a stretcher upstairs in that clinic looked out the window and saw him. She saw him praying in the snow, and she got off the stretcher and left the building. She went on to have the baby. And when asked later on about what happened that fateful day, what happened to change her mind, she said it was seeing the priest in the snow, because if a perfect stranger cared that much about her decision, how could she not care at least as much? That priest mattered more than he knew. And you do too. You are important as a family man, as a family woman, as the children of family. Most of you look privileged to live in families. You know that many, many millions of people around us don't, not the way you do. I've been privileged to speak on campuses a lot lately, and I can't count how many times I have met students who came up to talk afterwards and said that they were brought into the Protestant faith, the Catholic faith, after being raised with nothing, because what changed them was the experience of a loving family. There was one young lady I met in Colorado. I'll never forget what she said. I wrote it down as soon as she said it, so I wouldn't forget. She said, "I didn't know families could be like that, and I wanted to be like that too." And that is why she goes to church. So please remember things like that, too, when the inevitable bumps and bruises of domestic life get you down, as they do all of us human beings. You never know which of your children's friends or your students or colleagues might just be looking to you for inspiration in a given instant. Nor can you or any of us see the ripples outward of attempts to live up to pro-life and other beliefs. If you're lucky, you might catch a glimpse of one from time to time, but they're passing as a rainbow, and most of them will remain hidden from your eyes. Nonetheless, you're more important than you know. As the philosopher Karl Popper showed brilliantly in a book called The Poverty of Historicism, history is not on the side of movements claiming victory for themselves. The sexual revolution today has its cheerleaders, its web pages, lots of those, its style pages, its movies, and increasingly its laws. It does not yet have, or perhaps is just beginning to get, its Jonathan Swifts, its Charles Dickens, and other critics and witnesses who will last through the ages. Nonetheless, human beings are not only moral creatures, but also rational ones, at least collectively and over time, and eventually the secular record about the dark side of the revolution will make a dent. All you need to remember from today are two things. Myths are myths, not truths, and you, every one of you, is more important than you know. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please stay. We have many questions. Here. Thank you. What are your questions?
Oh, honey. This is wonderful. You taught them a lot. This is amazing. The importance of the work, even in Washington, D.C., and I realized that I forgot to tell you which think tank Mary is with. It's called the Hudson Institute. You're not? Are you with that? Oh, you're so moved. I'm okay. No wonder. Okay, because I saw that there, and I'm like, wait a minute, I forgot to tell you about her think tank. Okay, so moved over, but we do have some questions for you.
Yes.
Okay. Lots of questions. Do you know any prominent secularist who has changed their views based on this information?
Based on this kind of information? Well, some of the people I cited, like Irving Kristol, the late Irving Kristol, was not a religious person, but he was somebody who ran a magazine called The Public Interest that accumulated a lot of this kind of evidence about what was going on. Again, nobody around that place was religious. But they all became politically conservative because of it. Now, that's not the same as answering a question about, can I think of people who converted? I can think of people who have been brought in. I think Hadley Arkus, the constitutional law professor you'll be hearing from later today, is that right? My friend Hadley was someone who was brought into this movement because of the pro-life issue. I can think of a lot of people anecdotally who have been brought in because of abortion and who are on, you know, different parts of a spiritual path because of it. In England, there was a famous atheist whose name I'm completely blanking on, but who, Anthony Flew, who wrote a book at the end of his life, after 50 years as one of the brand name atheists of the UK, he wrote a book where he said he'd have reconsidered his view and he thought the argument for God was stronger than the argument against it. But that was because of different kinds of evidence. I don't know how much of a role the sexual revolution played in that, but certainly I'm sure all of you who are adults can think of people you've known who have been brought in because of the life issue and just starting there.
Seeing that even with Kirsten Powers writing about God's now. Okay, with women being more unhappy since the sexual revolution, would it be free to say, or fair to say, that men too are more unhappy?
Yes, that's a great question. I have a chapter in a book, Adam and Eve After the Pill, has a whole chapter about men and what's going on with men since the revolution. And the image that I use is that sexual liberation has been more like a slow-acting virus in men that isn't apparent in its negative effects until later in life, but it does its work. In other words, you know, it's one thing, and this is a point that I make repeatedly about the revolution. It empowers the strong. It hurts the weak. Its burden falls heaviest on the smallest and weakest shoulders, beginning with the issue of abortion, but not limited to that. For women, it's more immediate, obviously, being a single mom, finding yourself pregnant without a husband, etc. But for men, I think what needs to be looked at and isn't very often is what is it like to be alone later in life? What's happened when you stayed so long at the party of the revolution that your family walked away? That kind of thing. That's hard to measure, but I think has had a real and deleterious impact on men. And that's leaving aside the issue of pornography, which we mentioned briefly earlier.
And you say you mentioned that in your book. I wrote the name down. I'm getting that one. You mentioned Gilder a couple of times, too. And Men in Marriage, whoever asked that question, was one of the most excellent works, I believe, on this subject. He first named it Sexual Suicide.
But, yes.
And now incredible answering that question as well. Okay. Rome will soon host a council on the family in October, They're not sure. Any predictions, hopes? Will this be France's humanist Vitae Paul VI moment?
Okay, who wrote that? Was that one of the monks? I want to get Father up here to answer that one. You know, I don't know much about inside baseball, but one of my colleagues at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, George Weigel, who I'm sure is known to you, is over in Rome right now. So I hope I get a full report, but it won't do any good to whoever asked the question. I mean, you know, the interesting thing about Pope Francis is that there's so much hope on the progressive side of the ledger that he's going to change fundamental teachings that, you know, progressives are just very unrealistic about what the church is. They're very ignorant, truly, about what Christianity is, which is one reason the pro-life movement continues to have the upper moral hand in all of this. They don't understand that our side is the magnanimous side, for example. But one of the things they don't understand is that the Pope is not free to just turn over the catechism and say, I want it this way.
Oh, they gave me my own. So you can say, okay, I remember your article. This writer is telling you, pedophilia chick. And what can we do to slow down sexualization and increasingly, that is increasingly hitting younger, younger, and younger youth?
That's a great question, and I wish I knew, but I can see one thing that I think it would be very good to have happen. We need witnesses. You know, in Hollywood, if you remember the Roman Polanski case, where it sort of came out that there's this, you know, abiding interest in the young of a really, let's just call it unholy nature. There have been several child stars who have written pieces or memoirs where they have touched on this fact, you know, that they were solicited from a very early age in a very bad way. And I think that's not isolated. I mean, I think that's probably part of what happens when you live in an intensely visual world that favors the young commercially. And it would be good to see people like that come forward, whether they're religious or not, just to get the issue out into the light, as the Catholic Church has obviously had to do. Getting some heat and light on that subject would be very helpful.
Okay. All right. Do you have any predictions about where the pro-gay marriage laws will lead society?
Wasn't Ryan Anderson here yesterday?
Oh, yeah.
No, specifically, no. Obviously, traditional Christianity is up against a lot. But I am fundamentally an optimist, not a pessimist, about all of this for reasons talked about in the speech and because, you know, we think we've got the truth on our side. And it might be a long time before people can talk honestly or without penalty about certain subjects. That's where we are. But that doesn't mean we should lose hope. The success of the pro-life movement, again, the fact that millennials are more likely to be pro-life, including non-religious millennials than their parents were. This is a remarkable fact, and we just have to keep working it and building with whoever we can.
You have been listening to Mary Eberstadt, Senior Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and 2014 Bringing America Back to Life Symposium Speaker. This presentation was brought to you by Cleveland Right to Life, where through prayer, action, voting, and education, we are bringing America back to life.